and to Washington, D.C., and the White House, and Linda Kenyon. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning. It was a late night last night for Linda Kenyon.
Yeah.
As you can tell by my voice.
Yeah.
I was covering the president's speech to the Republican Governors Association, so that didn't end until late in the evening. The president has more energy than I do.
Yeah. Well, I hear he doesn't sleep anyway, so he probably doesn't need it.
Yeah, well, I'm human, and I do.
Well, the Senate stayed up late, too. In fact, they were like 4 o'clock
That's
in the morning
right.
your time.
Yes, they had what we call a votorama, where they voted after one amendment after another. Most of them voted down. But nonetheless, the Senate has passed a budget resolution. The vote was 52-48. The resolution is about $340 billion in funding, which includes $175 billion for border security and $150 billion for defense spending. Now, this is not what President Trump wanted. He wanted what he calls a big, beautiful bill, which would also include his 2017 tax cuts and his debt ceiling increase. The House is planning on moving forward with this blueprint, the big, beautiful bill. But senators on the Republican side of the aisle said, look, you know, it just makes this a whole lot easier to pass two separate bills. And Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota said, one of the reasons we're doing ours, this is a quote, is just in case they can't get consensus on their big, beautiful bill, we may have to do it in small, really beautiful bills. So the president likes the word beautiful a lot, so they're using it.
So the Senate doing a bill, of course, they cannot originate a money bill. It has to come from the House. Is the House likely to take up their bill now, the Senate bill?
Well, in the interest of time, what they might do is, in the best of possible worlds, the House would start right from scratch on its own bill. But what they could do is take the Senate bill, rename it, scoop out the creamy center, and fill it with their stuff.
Okay.
So that way it will look like it was originated in the House. But, you know, we don't know. March 14th is a government shutdown, and nobody wants a government shutdown, least of all the Republicans, because they're in control. If they show that they cannot pass a big, beautiful bill while they're in the control of the House and the Senate and the White House, then it really makes them seem weak. And you don't want to seem weak when you've got such control in Washington.
So what are the big high points in this Senate bill? I think one of them that I noticed was putting some money into border security.
Yeah, well, border security is a big deal. In fact, they're going to be spending more on border security than on defense spending. Almost $25 billion more on border security than on defense spending. So that may cause a little bit of a headache for a lot of the hawkish senators, a lot of the hawkish members of Congress in the House. But nonetheless, this is something that the Senate was able to pass despite some pushback from Senator Rand Paul, who often pushes back on bills to make a point. That he doesn't like the fact that this wasn't done, if you will, through regular order. In other words, going through the painstaking committee process, although much of it was, and that it's a lump sum bill. And he does get very vocal in the late hours of the night when there's votoramas.
But nonetheless, okay, when you say we're spending more money on the southern border than we are on defense, does that mean
yes.
somebody's ox is going to get gored locally?
Yeah, probably. And a lot of Republicans, while they have not been speaking out very vocally on the Senate floor, apparently have been contacting the White House and saying, hey, you know, this Department of Government Efficiency is starting to affect my district and I don't like it. And while they won't say that, you know, in public, they are starting to balk a little bit about, well, what happens to jobs in their district? What happens to their local economy, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I remember, you know, when they went through this with the Clinton administration going through and shutting down bus, military bases all over the country and what it did to some of these local communities. Case in point, Glasgow, Montana, they had the big Air Force base there. And when they shut that thing down, the town went from like 10, 12,000 people to less than 3,000 people, which is what's there today.
Yeah. We're going to see a lot of that kind of thing. If there are these drastic cuts in individual districts, a lot of them in Republican districts. And so this is why we're hearing some off the record stuff about some Republicans in particular who are balking because now they see how it's going to affect their districts and they don't like it.
Well, it was a close call yesterday, but FBI Director Kash Patel is now the director of the FBI. A man who has no law enforcement experience at all, now heading up the largest law enforcement agency in the country.
Yes. Republican Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski were the only Republicans who voted against confirmation. Now, Kash Patel, like many of the administration's cabinet picks and nominees, has been extremely controversial, but was confirmed mostly along party lines. And he has a literal list of political enemies that he has said he was going to go after if before he was even nominated for the FBI directorship. By the way, this is a seven-year job, so he's going to be in there for a long time. And that is, he will outlast the Trump administration. Although President Trump keeps floating the idea of trying to run for a third term, but that would require a constitutional amendment, not an easy thing to do. But nonetheless, Kash Patel has been known as a fiery Uber Trump supporter, which is exactly what Trump requires. He requires loyalty and he requires painstaking support, or you're not going to get picked for a job in his administration. And Kash Patel fits the bill on all scores.
You know, what strikes me about all of these is that these guys really wanted these jobs. But I remember the first time, the first Trump administration, I don't believe any of the cabinet members made it to full term.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of turnover, but Trump knows a lot more about how to do this job now, so he might be much more skilled in picking people who might last the distance. We'll have to see.
How much power does the director have as far as personnel?
The director of the FBI?
Or any agency, for that matter.
They have a lot of power. In fact, the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, is working with the new cabinet heads. I know that the new agriculture secretary, for example, the same day that she was confirmed, she was over at the White House and she told us that she hadn't even been on the job one day yet, but she welcomed the actions of the DOGE and she would welcome them with open arms into her agency to cut personnel. So the agency heads are working with DOGE. The agency heads, keep in mind, were confirmed by the U.S. Senate and were handpicked by Donald Trump. So they're going to go along with his agenda, and his agenda includes cutting the federal workforce and possibly eliminating federal agencies altogether. Some of those agencies, by the way, are the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, the Education Department, USAID, Agency for International Development, and he also wants to make drastic cuts at the IRS, which, by the way, is the agency that brings in the revenue. He wants to make thousands of cuts at the IRS. So that's an interesting juxtaposition.
Well, the Biden administration funded adding, 87,000 agents to the IRS over a 10-year period. How many of those actually were hired, I wonder?
Well, not that many, but there were enough to be now let go. And one of the reasons the Biden administration beefed up the IRS was in order to collect uncollected taxes, which includes, he said, a lot of millionaires and billionaires who were not paying their fair share and who were using various tax loopholes, whether they were legal or illegal, they needed to be looked into. And they were bringing in the revenue. And that was helping with, dealing with the deficit. And now the DOGE is talking about, with all of the savings by cutting all these positions, giving 20% back to the American people, putting 20% toward the paying down the debt, and the other in the budget or in the form of, if you will, tax cuts, many of which will go to wealthy Americans, and which is the exact opposite approach of the Biden administration. Now, we had the head of the National Economic Council at the White House yesterday, and we asked about, you know, giving this money back to American people as a stimulus check. And didn't you say that stimulus during the Biden administration was what contributed to inflation? And he kind of skirted the question and basically said, you know, that this is, it's a good thing, even though maybe during Biden it was not a good thing, essentially.
I want to spend a few minutes with you, Linda, and get your personal assessment. Mitch McConnell says he will not run for an eighth six-year term in the House. I'm sure that health is a big part of all of that. But talk with us about your personal experiences with the guy who led the Senate for more years than anybody else.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Congress without Mitch McConnell. He was there since the 1980s, long before I got there. So he was both Senate Majority Leader and Senate Minority Leader, the longest serving party leader in the U.S. Senate in U.S. history. Been there a very long time. He decided that he would make the announcement that he would retire on the Senate floor on his 83rd birthday, which was yesterday. Now, Mitch McConnell, for all of his political positions, et cetera, whether you agree or disagree with him, I always found him to be what I like to say, a brilliant tactician. He was a brilliant political tactician. He knew how to use the rules. He knew how to finesse this, that, and the other thing procedurally. All of these things are important in a leader in the U.S. Senate because the rules are pretty complex. And he finally met his match, I thought, when he was facing off against the then Senate Majority Leader, the Democratic leader, Harry Reid, who has since passed away. Now, Harry Reid was a brilliant tactician in his own right on the Democratic side of the aisle. And I think the two of them, while they may have had a couple of personal clashes, they did kind of enjoy each other. They liked the skullduggery. And McConnell was, you know, he was difficult to deal with in terms of, you know, if you wanted to oppose his policies. But he was a gentleman. He was a nice man, at least my interactions with him. And he made himself very accessible. He was especially accessible to the radio people. That I would call him or his assistants and say, I need to ask Senator McConnell a question. And they would make him available to me. Even during the political conventions in various cities over the years, I would call his staff and I would say, hey, I need to catch up with McConnell. Can he set aside a few minutes for me? And they would say yes. And they would find him in a hallway somewhere and they would direct me to him and he would always talk to me. And he didn't necessarily give me, you know, the answers maybe I was looking for, but he was always accessible. And he was very aware of the power of radio and was never turned me or, as far as I know, any of the other colleagues on the what we call Radio Row away. In fact, he would sometimes hold radio roundtables, so in his office around the conference table. So I have missed that because I never had any other party leader that accessible, and I haven't seen it since.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about something you informed us about that most of us had no idea, that he was a polio victim.
Yes, he was a polio victim, childhood survivor of polio, which is one of the reasons why he was vehemently opposed to confirmation of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head Health and Human Services because of Kennedy's anti-vax rhetoric and a lot of what has been deemed the misinformation and disinformation surrounding vaccines. And he said that he could not sit idly by while somebody was willing to take away vaccines, which are responsible for saving millions of lives and improving the quality of life for millions of people. And the polio as a child, a lot of people did not know this because it did not seem to affect him much. But I will tell you that there were certain things he could not do. He had trouble putting on his jacket. So he had a certain way of doing that. And he had trouble going up and down stairs. And he would sometimes belabor having to go up or down stairs. And, you know, understandably so. And that was because of his, you know, the after effects of his bout with childhood polio.
Well, he came during the Reagan administration, and he says he's got an agenda he's going to fulfill here in what's left of his term.
He says that, yes. He has so far been outspoken against a lot of Trump policies, but he did not speak out that much while he was in the majority or in the minority. And there's he did not vote against Donald Trump during the impeachment trials, saying that that was something that should be left up to the courts, and he was confident that the courts would take care of the situation, and that Donald Trump would never, ever be in the White House again. Well, Donald Trump is in the White House again, and the courts did not deal with the situation to the extent that perhaps McConnell had envisioned. And a lot of folks are saying, you know, McConnell, you shepherded through so many things that a lot of people oppose now, and you did the president's bidding. And they're saying, you know, you're speaking out now, but it's too little too late.
Linda, as always, we appreciate your great reporting, and thank you for drilling down for us this morning.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful weekend.